This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
In the 1990s, we started talking about global warming. The planet would slowly warm, scientists told us. Maybe that'd be good for people living with cold winters, kind of like Florida slowly moving to your house. Then we learned other things would be affected, like rainfall and rising seas, so we called it climate change. Around 2008, scientist John Holdren said it should be called climate disruption. Meanwhile, Europe has been back and forth between cold and strings of rainy storms. Instead of nice warm winters, the eastern United States has experienced a series of Arctic cold waves and record-setting snowfalls. In 2012, in a paper titled Evidence Linking Arctic Amplification to Extreme Weather in Mid-Latitudes, Dr. Jennifer Francis of Rutgers University offered a clear answer, and it was based on observations. The jet stream, that high air current, can drive weather patterns, and now it's slower and wavier due to warming in the Arctic. Her work has generated a little criticism and a lot of support. Now, 3 years later, Dr. Francis is back with co-author Stephen J. Vavris with an update. They say we have entered a new era driven by something called Arctic amplification. With so much at stake, it's a pleasure to welcome Dr. Jennifer Francis back to Radio EcoShock. Hello, Dr. Francis.
Hello, Alex. Thank you for having me.
Lots of people want to know what's going on with the weather. I appreciate you joining us. Let's start with the basics. What is Arctic amplification?
Well, it's a term that we give to this phenomenon that the Arctic is more sensitive to global temperature changes than pretty much anywhere else on the planet. And so when the globe warms, the Arctic warms more. And what we're seeing is a rapid warming of the Arctic, while the rest of the Earth is certainly warming, but nowhere near as fast as we're seeing up there.
How can you say we've entered a new era of weather?
I don't know that I can say it's a new era of weather per se, but this idea of Arctic amplification really only started about 10 to 15, maybe 20 years ago when we really started to see the Arctic warm up so fast. And so this is what we think is having a new impact on our weather patterns.
So the Arctic isn't going to get any cooler if we keep dumping greenhouse gases into the atmosphere.
You know, it goes up and down every year somewhat, but the general trend is definitely a warming one. And so, you know, some years it warms a lot and some years it doesn't warm quite so much. But the trend is very clear.
I know my East Coast listeners are praying these kinds of vicious winters are not the new normal. Is it possible that they are?
Well, we know that overall, as we continue to increase the amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, that we should see a general tendency for record cold events to wane, and we'll see more record warm events. So while we expect this general trend to continue, there is the chance that we'll have these very cold winters like this when the jet stream tends to take up a pattern like it is right now, with a big southward dip right over the eastern half of North America, which allows Arctic air to penetrate farther south than it normally would. But the tendency for these very cold winters probably overall will wane.
So going back to 2012, the main message many of us got from your first paper on this was that the disappearance of sea ice in the Arctic was the driving factor behind weather changes in the fall and winter in the Northern Hemisphere. Your latest work goes well beyond that. Could you explain for us?
Sure. Well, I should first say that, you know, the changes in the Arctic are one factor. There's a lot of changes happening in the climate system simultaneously. And it's one of our challenges is to separate these individual factors and their impacts on weather patterns in mid-latitude. So our hypothesis is that the Arctic is having an effect, but certainly there are other things going on at the same time. So the idea is that because the Arctic is warming so fast, the difference in temperature between the Arctic and areas farther south is getting smaller. And it's that difference in temperature that is really the main fuel driving the jet stream winds. So as that temperature difference gets smaller, the west to east winds of the jet stream are also getting weaker. And this is something that we can measure. We know that when those winds in the jet stream get weaker, the jet stream tends to take a wavier path as it travels around the northern hemisphere. So it tends to wander north and south in bigger swings. And this pattern that we're having this winter, and which looks a whole lot like the pattern last winter, is a very good example of one of these patterns that we're talking about. So there's a huge northward swing over the western part of North America and a big southward dip over the east. And this has huge impacts on the weather that we experience down here on the surface. So as you know, out west they're having terrible drought and heat waves, while in the east it's just the opposite. We're going through a winter of record-breaking cold, and along the east coast it's been extremely stormy with snowstorm after snowstorm piling up the snow along the east coast. So what our latest work has shown is that we're actually able to measure an increased frequency of these types of patterns, and this type of pattern being when the jet stream gets into one of these very wavy configurations with a big northward swing and a big southward swing. And we're seeing this happen particularly over North America and the Atlantic. It seems to be sort of the hot spot for these very wavy patterns to set up. So that was one of the new results that came out of our recent research.
So as you say, we know planet Earth came with some big cycles and natural variability even before humans changed the atmosphere. And one of them is very important to weather in the north, and that's the alternation in pressure zones called the Arctic Oscillation or the Northern Annular Mode. Please tell us what that is and then how it relates to your work on the jet stream.
Right. So you can think of the Arctic Oscillation and whether it's positive or negative as being an indicator of the strength of the jet stream. When the Arctic Oscillation is in its so-called positive mode, the jet stream tends to be very strong. It means that that pressure difference between the Arctic and the areas farther south is large. So when we have that positive mode and the jet stream is strong, it tends to travel quite straight in a sort of straight circle around the northern hemisphere. We don't have these really big waves that I was just describing. And when it's in its negative mode, the opposite phase, is when we tend to see these very wavy patterns in the jet stream. And so it's linked to this idea that we're talking about, and there has been a tendency in the last several years for this Arctic oscillation to tend towards a more negative phase. So this is the phase where it tends to be very wavy. The jet stream tends to be very wavy.
Is the Arctic oscillation alone enough to explain the strange things we're seeing with the jet stream?
No, I don't think it is, because the Arctic Oscillation is a average index for the whole northern hemisphere, and what we tend to see is a wavy pattern setting up in one area and maybe not so much somewhere else. And it tends to vary in where these wavy patterns set up from one year to another. In fact, this winter is a great example because the Arctic Oscillation has actually been in a fairly positive mode most of the winter, yet in North America and in the eastern Pacific and in the Atlantic, we've had an extremely wavy pattern to the jet stream. So the Arctic Oscillation is an indicator, but it's often not very good in terms of particular locations.
And what about the impact of warming oceans, including the record high temperatures right along New England, where so many snowy storms hit this past winter?
Right. Well, there's a couple of sides to that story. We have very warm waters off of the Pacific coast, and they're also very warm off the Atlantic. And there are two impacts of those warm waters. As you said, along the East Coast, the warm waters are contributing to our very stormy winter and our very heavy snowfalls. When that water is extra warm off our coast, it does a couple of things. It increases the temperature difference between the land and the ocean, and that temperature difference is a source of energy for storms. And also, when the water's warm, we tend to get more evaporation, which provides more moisture for those storms. So we have the possibility of having heavier snowstorms, for example, in the winter, or heavier downpours if it happens to be a rain event. So that's what's contributing to our very stormy winter along the East Coast. But out in the West, and the very warm waters that are in place right now off of the Pacific coast, we think are contributing to this very wavy pattern, in fact. And that northward swing in the jet stream I mentioned out west is probably being fueled partially by this very warm water that's sitting off the west coast.
Another challenge for research has been the different patterns in different seasons. The last time I talked with you, a couple of years ago, you seemed fairly sure about what was happening in the fall and winter, but less sure about the spring and summer. Is this Arctic change affecting all four seasons now?
Well, we think it is. And since we talked a couple of years ago, there's been a lot of research been done by a bunch of different groups around the world looking at this linkage between Arctic change and weather patterns in mid-latitudes. And what we've learned is that the mechanisms that are creating the linkages vary with season and with location. So there isn't sort of one story we can tell that explains this linkage. A group in Germany, for example, has been looking at connections between ice loss in the Arctic and summer extreme weather patterns over Europe and Asia, and finding that the loss of sea ice in the summertime is contributing to these sorts of extreme events because that warming in the Arctic is causing the jet stream to split. Sometimes in the summer, it's more likely to do that when there's less sea ice. And when the jet stream splits, it tends to trap these waves in the jet stream, and they tend to stay in one place. And that leads to some of the extreme events that are related to very persistent weather patterns, like heat waves and drought and flooding. So that's, you know, one of these mechanisms that have been studied that is just a summer mechanism. There are others that people have been identifying that occur only in the wintertime. One of these that appears to be very robust is a link to ice loss over Western Russia in the Arctic area just north of Western Russia, and that seems to be causing the tendency for very cold winters over Central Asia. So a lot of people are looking at these various aspects of the linkage, and we're learning a lot.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with scientist Dr. Jennifer Francis of Rutgers University in New Jersey. We're talking about her work showing the jet stream has been changed by warming in the Arctic and how that leads to differences in weather in the Northern Hemisphere. So, Dr. Francis, not everyone agrees with your work. In December, I interviewed Dr. Kevin Trenberth of the Snow and Ice Data Center. He hesitated to agree with your findings and suggested things like Tropical Storm Nuri hitting Alaska are also important factors. There was even a paper out from Elizabeth Barnes of Colorado State University contradicting your findings. How do you respond to these critics?
Well, I'm the first to admit, as I said in the very beginning, that the Arctic warming is not the only factor that's changing in the climate system. And our challenge, or one of our challenges, is to sort out how these different changes in the climate system are affecting mid-latitude weather patterns. So I agree with Kevin Trenberth that, yes, indeed, hurricane or tropical storm Nuri had a big impact on the jet stream. We know that when tropical systems interact with the jet stream, they can have a big impact. And, you know, we've seen that going back in time, and we'll see it going forward into the future. But that doesn't mean that the Arctic isn't also playing a role. And in fact, there was a new paper that came out just this week by a group in Korea showing how the very extreme pattern last winter that looks very much like the pattern that we're experiencing right now with this big northward swing in the jet stream over the west and the big dip over the east was caused by a combination of sea surface temperature patterns in the Pacific and sea ice loss in the Arctic. So the sea surface temperatures in the Pacific tend to favor this kind of pattern, but because we've lost so much sea ice, the pattern has been intensified. So, you know, I agree that the tropics are also very important, but we're also seeing this maybe amplifying effect due to the Arctic. And I just wanted to make one correction to your statement relative to Elizabeth Barnes's work. Her research did not contradict our research. It just pointed out the fact that it's very difficult to extricate one factor from this very noisy climate system that we're dealing with. So she was not able to come up with a statistically robust repetition of our work, but it's not like she came out and said, you know, we're wrong, and I find something completely different.
All right. Now, leading to that, how well can climate models predict what we actually observe in these things that we're talking about?
Well, that's actually another challenge that we're facing. The climate models seem to have a problem with simulating these very wavy jet stream patterns. And in particular, there's a phenomenon called a blocking high. And that's when the jet stream takes such a big northward swing that it actually breaks off into a separate eddy, if you will, just like an eddy in a river. And when those happen, the weather patterns on either side of those blocking patterns get stuck in place for a long time. And we think that some climate models do a better job of simulating these than others. We're still looking into why some of them are able to create them and some don't do them very well. So that's one of the questions that we're dealing with.
And what does your study predict will happen for both the jet stream and for weather in the Northern Hemisphere if we continue to operate a civilization based on dumping excess carbon into the atmosphere?
Well, I think I'd have to say that we'll see a continuation of these wavy jet stream patterns because we expect the Arctic to continue to warm much faster than areas to the south. Perhaps we'll see kind of a leveling off in the fall as we go towards an Arctic summer system with no sea ice at all in it. But I think we'll see an increase in these very wavy patterns in the other seasons as we continue to lose sea ice in the other seasons as well. So we've seen this Arctic amplification being strongest in the fall and the winter so far, but it's also increasing in the spring and the summer. So those seasons we should start to see a stronger response of the jet stream.
I got a little confused by a couple of points in your paper's conclusion and discussion. First of all, you write, while weaker zonal winds have been observed in response to reduced poleward temperature gradients, the link to a wavier upper-level flow has not yet been confirmed. And I thought your paper really was confirming that. How does this change in lower-level winds actually change the high-level jet stream?
Right. So this is kind of a comment to reviewers of our paper saying that, you know, you can't make a strong statement yet about how the waviness of the jet stream is responding to a rapidly warming Arctic. I actually agree with you. I think that we provided some pretty convincing evidence that when we see these areas of rapid warming in the Arctic, that we at the same time see the winds in the upper levels becoming more wavy. But, you know, not everybody agrees with us yet, and we still have to provide more evidence of this phenomenon happening in the real world.
Right about now, Jennifer Francis, some listeners in New England are thinking about a move to the West Coast. That sounds really good. Should they do it?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, I think life on the East Coast is wonderful, and I think maybe they should just take up a winter sports that they enjoy. You know, if you really can't stand the cold, then you probably shouldn't be living in the East anyway, because that's just the way winters are in the East Coast. But that said, I think going forward, what we'll probably see are plenty of cold winters, but, you know, you don't have to look back very far in time to see a very warm winter. In fact, the winter of 2012, people forget when they're in a situation like we're experiencing this winter that only a couple of years ago we broke thousands, like literally over 3,000 high temperature records in the winter of 2012. So I think my message would be get ready for weirdness, not necessarily one type of winter versus another. You know, some winters they're going to be like the one we're experiencing now, but, you know, maybe next year we'll have just the opposite.
What can our listeners in Europe and Russia take from your research?
They're experiencing their own very unusual conditions. Just this winter and the winter before, the UK, I think you mentioned in your introduction, has been experiencing a very stormy winter. They set all-time records for precipitation last winter, and those records go back to over 250 years in parts of the UK. But at the same time, you'll remember the Sochi Olympics were having a hard time keeping snow on the ski slopes for the ski events. And this winter as well, they're having a very warm pattern in much of Scandinavia and that part of Europe. So they too are having some very unusual conditions that tend to be very persistent. And that's really the bottom line of what our research is suggesting, is that we should be seeing weather patterns that are more persistent. And that goes along with these very wavy jet stream situations. We know that when the waves get very large in the jet stream, they tend to not move very quickly. And because those waves create the weather that we experience, the conclusion is that we should start to see, and we are seeing, more persistent weather patterns.
Well, as we wrap up, your name is becoming associated with the science behind some rotten changes in weather. The TV weather people don't explain the causes of this exciting weather porn, but when they do mention it, I've heard your name. Did it surprise you to acquire this public role?
Yes, it did. I certainly didn't see it coming. Looking back, I can understand why people might be very interested in all this, because there's a couple reasons. First of all, they're noticing that the weather that they're experiencing in their own regions is behaving very weirdly now. And we have data to back that up. There are more extreme events now in terms of weather than there used to be. And the other thing is, it's something that we're connecting to the Arctic, and the Arctic is somewhere that people can look and see climate change happening before their very eyes. They can see maps of sea ice extent, for example, and notice that half of it's gone just compared to 30 years ago. So they're able to make this link in their own minds between a very obvious change in the climate system up in the Arctic and relate that. We're providing a way to relate that to what's happening in their own backyards and their own personal experience. And so, you know, it's got people talking. I think people are realizing that climate change is not going to be this gradual warming that'll happen to their grandchildren. It's something that's happening today, and we have a explanation for why that might be.
We've been talking with Dr. Jennifer Francis. She's a research scientist with the Institute of Marine and Coastal Sciences at Rutgers University in New Jersey. Her new paper, Evidence for a Wavier Jet Stream in Response to Rapid Arctic Warming, was published in the journal Environmental Research Letters in January of 2015. Find links to everything we've talked about in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Dr. Francis, thank you so much for taking time to explain your work.
You're very welcome. Anytime.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. Let's look deeper into a few issues raised in this interview with Jennifer Francis. First of all, why does this new paper say we are in a new era of Arctic amplification, or AA? We have reliable temperature and other weather readings from the Arctic starting in 1940. According to this paper, starting in the 1990s, in the same time frame as the sea ice declined, Arctic amplification could be seen in all four seasons for the first time. It hadn't been seen in records when they were started in 1940 and on to 1990. So that's one sign of a new era. Going further, the paper says, quote, "It is important to note the recent emergence of the signal of Arctic amplification from the noise of natural variability. Since about 1995 near the surface, and since the year 2000 in the lower troposphere. This short period represents a substantial challenge to the detection of robust signals of atmospheric response amid the noise of natural variability. Thus, for this study, we define the period from 1995 to 2013 as the Arctic amplification era." So, we've entered a new era, courtesy of what's happening up there in the far north. You'll notice I spent a little time with Dr. Francis on the natural cycle called the Arctic Oscillation, and sometimes called the Northern Annular Mode. We'll stick with Arctic Oscillation, or AO. So pay attention to this statement by Dr. James Hansen of NASA, which exactly explains this past winter. He says, "When the AO index is negative, there tends to be high pressure in the polar region, weaker zonal winds, and greater movement of frigid polar air into the middle latitudes." That's from Hansen's 2009 paper called "If It's That Warm, How Come It's So Damn Cold?" And it's too bad climate denier Senator James Inhofe is too dumb to understand it. Now, I specifically asked Jennifer Francis about the Arctic Oscillation because if that's all it is, the awful weather pattern in the U.S. Northeast will just go away when the Arctic Oscillation goes positive. Francis has three answers, really. First, the Arctic Oscillation is not a final indicator of getting a disturbed jet stream and a polar vortex in North America. This past winter had a positive AO and still got hit with polar weather further south. Secondly, we can see that the pole is warming with ice melting, permafrost thawing, and a much warmer winter in Alaska, for example, because of climate change. Finally, though, the super cold winters in eastern North America will get less frequent over time, she tells us, because we're warming the whole planet. I did a Radio EcoShock show titled Summer in March back in 2012 because that winter was so frequently warm. People were playing tennis in New York City parks in January that year. Parents in Quebec couldn't get the traditional outdoor skating rinks to freeze. The unpleasant answer is we have caused climate disruption. Expect the unexpected, good and bad.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. I want to move on to talk about the IPCC and something called the RPC. I'll explain. Evidence is growing that the Paris climate talks at the end of 2015 are an exercise in futility. A couple of Radio EcoShock listeners alerted me to this dangerous charade. It's explained best by the UK filmmaker and climate blogger Nick Breeze at Envisionation. Here's the audio segment from Nick's latest film Warning.
In the latest Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's fifth assessment report, that's IPCC AR5, there have been published a selection of representative concentration pathways, or RCPs. Dr. Matt Watson from the School of Earth Sciences at the University of Bristol in the UK made this point strongly at a recent meeting at the Royal Society in London.
This is why this is the latest projections from the International Panel of Climate Change. And the alarming thing, which again Sir Brian highlighted, is that these two scenarios actually explicitly include negative emissions technologies. So there is geoengineering of the flavour of carbon dioxide removal in the best case scenarios. The very, very alarming thing for us is that we are on this path here. That's AR 8.5. We are slap bang on this trajectory. And that puts us in a very, very different place in our children's or our grandchildren's lifetimes.
Of the scenarios projected into the future, only two appear to be able to keep us close to a 2-degree rise of temperature. As Dr. Watson mentioned just now, these are called respectively RCP 2.6 and RCP 4.5. This chart is intended to give an idea of what concentrations of greenhouse gases take us to what temperatures, with 2 degrees Celsius being the consensus limit for safety. The amber and the black coloured lines are from historical records, and the red, green and blue are forecasts. As Watson alluded to, the RCP we are currently on is the red one titled RCP 8.5. This is not a survivable path. The RCPs from 4.5 to 8.5 will cause us to lose our tree sink and the ice sheets. Without the trees, we will be inundated with greenhouse gases, and humanity simply will not be able to survive. This leaves RCP 2.6, which has an estimated temperature range of 0.9 to 2.3 degrees Celsius. We are already very close to the 0.9 degree scenario, so our chances of staying within the range of temperature are very slim, especially when you consider that emissions are still estimated to increase. Former President of the Royal Society, Professor Martin Rees, made this statement during our interview.
I think we all hope that emission reductions will be achieved, but the lack of success of current attempts at international agreements encourages pessimism. And I honestly would bet, sad though it is, that the annual CO2 emissions are going to rise year by year for at least the next 20 years, and that'll build up a cumulative level close to 500 parts per million by then.
Based on what we know, it is fair to say that the Earth's sensitivity to greenhouse gas emissions mean that we will experience a great deal more heating yet, with an added boost from feedback such as methane releases and tree loss. However, there is another fly in the ointment regarding nearly all of the representative concentration pathways. As Dr. Watson said, they actually factor in a geoengineering solution called carbon dioxide removal, or CDR, whereby billions of tons of carbon are actually removed from the atmosphere and stored somewhere on Earth, either as some form of biochar or perhaps as living matter called biomass. But as is widely known, no such technology actually exists, and the research into developing it has been riddled with controversy, conspiracy, governmental inaction, misrepresentation, and a whole host of other inhibitors. The bottom line is that we are basing our collective future safety on this planet on pure science fiction.
If we want to sequester CO2 and make a difference, we have to sequester something which is a significant fraction of 35 billion tons per year. So what's a significant fraction of 35 billion? Let's say 20 billion tons. 10 billion tons even, let's make a start. 10 billion tons a year of carbon sequestration. We don't do anything on this planet on that scale. We don't manufacture food on that scale. We don't mine iron ore on that scale. We don't even produce oil, coal, or gas on that scale. Iron ore is below a billion tons a year. How are we going to invent a technology from scratch, highly complicated technology, to the tune of 10 billion tons a year?
Deputy Director of the Tyndall Centre for Climate Change Research, Professor Kevin Anderson, said this in a recent interview.
It's also really important to note that we are already, when we are developing our emission scenarios, our ways of thinking about the future, virtually every single emission scenario that is aimed at meeting our climate change obligations that we sign up to internationally, so this idea of keeping the rising global average temperature to below 2 degrees C, virtually every single emission scenario that we've so far generated on that includes geoengineering. It assumes it automatically works. Now, that's fine if one or two of the scenarios have that, but almost every single scenario has it. So already what we're finding is that geoengineering, even though it is still in a very experimental conceptual stage, that we are assuming it will work and we are embedding it in our scenarios, and from those are what we go on to advise policymakers from. So it is already having a really very pernicious effect in trying to, in influencing what it is policymakers, what it is civil society, what it is that companies and other people who are not directly involved in the science understand about climate change. And if you talk to most of the policymakers, they're not aware that actually already in all of the advice they're getting from scientists, there's an assumption that we'll be able to suck the CO2 out of the atmosphere in the future. That is already occurring today.
We have a very real and very serious crisis on our hands. We cannot allow emissions of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases to keep rising. We have to reverse the trend, and fast. We are currently at the dangerous level of 400 parts per million of carbon dioxide and rising. In the pre-industrial era, we were around 280 parts per million. To be safe, we should be aiming to reduce the concentration to beneath 320 parts per million. This means developing a means of removing billions of tons of greenhouse gases from the atmosphere. We should be very concerned that the IPCC have included the use of geoengineering technology in their future emission scenario, and that the actual technology does not currently exist and is not even being adequately researched or funded.
That was audio from a new short film by Nick Breeze titled Survivable IPCC Projections Are Based on Science Fiction. You can find it at envisionation.co.uk, so that's envisionation.co.uk, or use the link in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Nick does some great interviews, often with prominent climate scientists. It pays to keep visiting his site. So, the Paris Climate Talks are already a sellout of humanity and all species, even if they are a so-called success, which is doubtful. I'd say the best climate activists can do at this point is to push their country governments to do far more and to include a new vision of naturally capturing carbon back into the soil. As we've heard from recent Radio EcoShock guests like Thomas Goreau and Kristen Olson, we can lower the burden of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere by changing the way we do agriculture. That will need a parallel shift in our whole economy and lifestyles, yes, but it can work. Unlike the fairy tale tech of carbon capture and storage, we know how to put large amounts of carbon back into the soil. So far, the climate talks do not even include the soil carbon option. Let's try and change that before it's really, really too late. Get soil carbon into the Paris Climate Talks. Pass the word.
Radio EcoShock.
Humans are changing the planet in many ways, but we are not alone out there. There are diseases looking for new conquests and parasites being spread around the world by air travel, shipping, and resource extraction. Experts warn we are already in a crisis of emerging infectious disease, or EID. We have one of those experts with us now. Dr. Daniel Brooks was a longtime zoology professor at the University of Toronto. Now he's a senior research fellow with the Mantor Laboratory of Parasitology at the University of Nebraska. Dr. Brooks is also a visiting scholar in Brazil and Hungary. His latest paper was published February 15, 2015, in the journal Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society. It warns climate change will bring us new and dangerous guests. Dr. Brooks, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
What are the signs that a crisis of spreading diseases is upon us?
Well, what I would have to say is that what we hear about in the mass media, that is, these emerging diseases that are affecting human beings, is only the tip of the iceberg. They're the ones that affect human health most immediately, and so they get most of the attention. But the same kind of dynamic that is at work that occasionally produces new diseases directly in human beings is happening more broadly all over the globe, and it's affecting all species of plants and animals, including all of those that human beings rely on for their own socioeconomic maintenance and their own standard of living and their own survival. So what we're talking about is emerging diseases, not just in humans, but also in crops and livestock and even wildlife that humans, at least some human beings, depend on for their livelihood.
Well, just to get one thing out of the way, getting back to humans, do you expect our species to be decimated by a super disease?
No, absolutely not. In fact, our perspective is, in a way, it's kind of the opposite of the Andromeda strain. What we expect to happen, we expect to see a lot of fairly localized disease outbreaks, none of which really have the possibility of doing severe damage on a global scale to humanity. But every one of these outbreaks does cost something. It does exact some sort of cost on human resources. And so our concern about climate change and emerging diseases and the future of humanity has more to do with the possibility that because we're not anticipating having lots of emerging diseases, we're not prepared for them. We only respond to them after they happen, and we hope that each one is the last one. But if we're correct, there are going to be many, many of these, and if we don't begin to anticipate that they're going to happen, then we won't be able to adopt measures for mitigating their effects. Eventually, rather than, you know, one Andromeda strain that kills all of humanity, what we end up with is something that Eric Hoberg and I have called death by a thousand cuts. So lots and lots and lots of little diseases, each one of which has a particular cost. And eventually there's so many of them that they overwhelm the healthcare and veterinary care delivery services.
Let's back up a little bit. Is there a difference between diseases and parasites?
Well, there's a difference. In a sense. Disease, many, many organisms are capable of creating a disease syndrome in an organism. So, for example, some viruses cause disease and some don't. But in addition to that, some people who are infected with some viruses or some bacteria are diseased, and some are infected but not diseased. So a good example of that would be Streptococcus bacteria. Every human being has a colony of Streptococcus bacteria living in their throats. But at any one time, very few human beings have what we call a strep throat. That is, very few human beings actually are in a disease situation with respect to their relationship with the Streptococcus. Streptococcus is always potentially capable of producing disease, but in that particular case, usually a strep throat is associated with the Streptococcus plus the human being plus something else, like the human being stressed out or very tired or worn down for some reason. And so what we have is the potential for disease is there in a lot of organisms. And in the case of emerging diseases, there's a much higher probability that disease will happen, because in emerging diseases, you have pathogenic organisms or parasites that are moving into hosts that are susceptible, but they've never been exposed before, which means they've never had the opportunity to develop resistance.
So your new paper, co-authored with Eric Hoberg of the USDA Research Service, you found a disturbing trend. Scientists previously counted on parasites and diseases becoming ever more adapted to their hosts and so limited to just them. Can you first describe that process and then what you found could happen instead?
Right. Well, yes, that particular process, the idea is that there's a trade-off between how well adapted a particular parasite or pathogen is to a particular host and the ability to survive another host. So the idea is that the more, you know, in a sort of a metaphorical sense, the more time and effort you put into one relationship, the less likely it is you'll be able to establish another relationship. And if that's true, and that's the way Eric and I were trained as graduate students as well. If that's true, then one of the things that should be true is that we should see very few parasites or other pathogens jumping from one host to another. And yet we see that all the time. And in the last 30 years, Eric and I, my work in the tropics and his work in the Arctic, both of us have seen this happening a lot in real time. And so we wondered what this was about because it was different from what we'd been taught. We then both did a series of deep evolutionary analyses, and what we discovered was that in the evolutionary past, the last ice age, 15 million years ago, even as long as 65 million years ago, what we find is that these emerging diseases, that is, pathogens jumping to new hosts, there are bursts of them in evolutionary history, and each one of those bursts is highly correlated with a period of time when there was a massive climate change event. And so what we began to realize, or we believe what is happening, is that the climate change drives all kinds of species to move around. They change their geographic distributions, and human beings are accelerating that because we move ourselves and we move crops and livestock all over the world as well. And that just accelerates that general process of species moving around and moving around. And the more species move around, the more likely it is that they're going to come into contact with a pathogen that they're susceptible to, but they've never seen before. And that pathogen is going to jump immediately into that new host. But because there's no resistance, the association between that pathogen and its new host will be a disease relationship.
And you also brought out the intriguing idea that they could revert to what you called ancestral genetic capabilities.
Well, they don't revert to it. They retain it. Okay. Now, most people, most non-biologists don't really understand that most of the characteristics, say, that human beings have are persistent ancestral characteristics. These are characteristics that evolved long before human beings did. For example, every cell in your body has its DNA inside a membrane, something called a nucleus. And cells with a nucleus like that evolved about 1.5 billion years ago. And the fact that we have that kind of cell structure is a persistent ancestral legacy of 1.5 billion years ago. So what happens with all organisms is that they have many more capabilities than they show at any one time. And a lot of those capabilities are based on their ancestry. So we know, for example, that let's say you've got a chimpanzee living in an area where there are other primates, there's a high likelihood that the chimpanzee might pick up parasites from the other primate, or the other primates might pick up parasites from the chimpanzees because they're very similar, because they're closely related, and they have a lot of ancestral similarities in common. And the parasites oftentimes can be very, very specialized on a characteristic that one host has, but there may be other hosts that share that exact same characteristic because of common ancestry. And that means that those other hosts are sitting in some other part of the world. And if the parasite ever gets to them, the parasite's going to think it's just more of the same kind of host material, and it will jump immediately into the new host.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith talking with Dr. Daniel Brooks about climate change and the spread of diseases and parasites. You know, Dr. Brooks, West Nile virus scared the pants off many people when it first arrived in North America. And as a Canadian, we can hardly avoid being bitten by mosquitoes, you know. So, but we haven't seen many deaths from it. Why not?
Well, okay, West Nile virus, actually, it wasn't the West Nile virus introduction to North America is actually a really good example of what we're talking about. When it was first introduced to North America, no one should have been surprised, number one, that it could be introduced successfully, because there are songbirds in North America and there are human beings in North America. And in Africa and in Russia, where West Nile virus shows up all the time, it's in humans and it's in songbirds. So the fact that they're humans and songbirds in North America means that if West Nile ever got to North America, there's a high probability that it was going to become established. And it did become established. And the first thing that happened was that it spread into populations of human beings that had never seen it before and populations of songbirds and species of songbirds that had never been exposed to West Nile virus before. And the first thing that happened was massive acute disease outbreak. Lots of birds died, a fair number of human beings died, a lot got sick. But now, a decade later, or whatever it is, the songbird populations have recovered, and very few birds and very few humans are actually getting sick each year or dying from West Nile virus. However, West Nile virus is still here, and it's never going to go away. And so that means that there's always going to be the potential for a new outbreak in the future. This is what we're worried about in terms of the socioeconomic implications, that each one of these, see, we could say right now West Nile virus is not costing society very much, but it's costing something. And each one of these diseases that comes in is going to cost something. And eventually there's going to be a huge impact in terms of the economics of trying to deal with a whole bunch of these emerging diseases, even though each one of them may be relatively minor by itself.
Does the scientific community have predictions of what can happen with diseases and parasites, say, by 2050 or by 2100, if the world stays on its current carbon-burning path?
The short answer is yes, there are lots of predictions. But a slightly longer answer is that Eric and I believe that those projections grossly underestimate what's going to happen, because they're based on the assumption that emerging diseases are going to be relatively rare, that parasites don't jump hosts. So the idea is that, well, yes, climate change may move species around with their pathogens, but the assumption is that those pathogens will stay with the original host. And what we're saying is, no, things are going to jump around a lot. And that means that whatever projections we have right now, I mean, Eric and I would say, and parenthetically, we'd love to be wrong, but if we're correct, then the projection should be that there are going to be a lot of emerging diseases, and a lot of them are going to be in crops and livestock and wildlife that are not infecting human beings, but they are causing economic hardship to human beings by affecting our food supply and affecting the livelihoods of people in agriculture.
And you don't present this emerging crisis as just a medical issue. What is it really if it's not just medical?
Well, it's a socioeconomic crisis. I mean, basically what we're looking at is the possibility of disruptions in food, disruptions in jobs associated with food production, and therefore indirect effects on human beings. You know, working in the tropics and developing countries, I've worked in many places where if the local pigs, for example, became infected with some novel parasite and most of them died, a lot of people in a remote village might die as well. They would have nothing to eat. They would have no way to sustain themselves. And if the emerging disease crisis is correlated with climate change and biodiversity, we have to remember that the vast majority of the world's biodiversity occurs in places where the vast majority of the world's poor people live. And on top of that, if our scenario is correct and it's movements of people and animals around the planet that are associated with moving pathogens around and creating the opportunities for pathogens to jump into new hosts, then things like refugee human beings displaced by warfare are going to be a not insignificant contributor to moving diseases around the planet. So all of this, the medical part of it, turns out to be a critical element, but not the big picture. It's embedded in the larger picture.
Well, now, just to take the bleak view, if we are entering a sixth great mass extinction, in part due to climate change, How are these pests at surviving such climate changes?
Oh, that's a great, great question. And this is one of the most fundamentally important pieces of research in this whole area. It was something that was done by Eric Hoberg. Eric was working in the Arctic, working on seabirds in a family called the Alcidae, puffins and murrelets and things like that, these beautiful marine birds. And Eric found that these birds are inhabited by or infected by groups of parasites that are much, much older than the birds themselves. So that group of birds as a group, an evolutionary group, let's say is 35 million years old. But the parasites, we can do this genetic dating of the parasites and the host. We find that the parasites are nearly 100 million years old. And so it appears that these parasites were originally in marine dinosaur-like things, plesiosaurs and mosasaurs and things like that, these great big marine reptiles, all of which went extinct at the end of the Cretaceous period that's associated with the massive asteroid strike on Earth. And all of those original hosts went extinct, but the parasites didn't. The parasites went right through that mass extinction event and simply changed hosts. And so now we have 100 million year old parasites living in 35 million year old birds. So it looks like one of the things about these parasites and pathogens is that they are extraordinarily good survivors. And we can't count on a mass extinction event to wipe out a lot of pathogens. Maybe the exact opposite.
Oh, boy. Well, now, on the front line, we have veterinarians. They often discover sick animals, whether they're on the farms or as pets. Do the vets have a good pathway to stay tuned to what disease experts know if things evolve rapidly?
That's also an excellent question. The short answer is we don't have a good general mechanism for that. Not in North America, much less in developing parts of the world. That's one of the things that Eric and I suggest is what we need to be doing is we need more and more basic scientists, natural history people and ecologists and taxonomists in museums actually working to provide much more detailed information about what is out there that could potentially show up in your cattle or your horses or eating your apple trees. And we don't, at the moment, you're right, we don't have a good network and a good means of communication for that. The main reason we don't have that is because we don't have money and we don't have governmental policy. Those two things are tied together. In the United States, for example, as soon as the American government decides to stop being stupid and admit that climate change is real, then it's possible to have actual public policies based on we need to adapt to climate change. Once that happens, then it's possible to obtain new research money to actually do something about implementing policies to adapt to change. But until there's a political will, the scientists are basically, like me, are just basically sitting here twiddling our thumbs and saying, you know, if you ever need us, we're here. we're ready. It's like sometimes I tell people, don't be afraid, we have a plan. But at the moment, nobody wants to hear the plan. Nobody that can say yes to major public policy wants to hear about that plan yet.
Not until it costs us enough money that Wall Street notices it on the balance books, I suppose.
Yeah, that's what we're afraid of, is that we will wait until, you know, the crisis is overwhelming us before we decide to do something.
So we have had a very good run here in the West. We're conquering or almost conquering many diseases of the ages. How confident should we be that this will just continue?
What will continue?
Well, it's almost like we have a magic shield that we think that vaccines and the medicines will protect us. So whatever new diseases or pests show up, we'll handle it.
Well, I would say that our biggest cause for concern is that the world's largest experiments in natural selection have been all of these massive global experiments that the pharmaceutical industry has been doing in trying to provoke the emergence of antibiotic pathogens. And it happens, it works every time. Natural selection works all the time. And the pharmaceutical industry is able to produce these antibiotic resistant strains all the time, which of course gives them a reason to charge more money to develop yet more drugs to try to get ahead of the next one and the next one and the next one. And the reality is that We're not winning this. This is not a golden age.
That's a shocker. All right, listeners, the article by our guest, who is a longtime Canadian professor, Daniel Brooks, and Eric Hoberg from the USDA, is titled Evolution in Action, Climate Change, Biodiversity Dynamics, and Emerging Infectious Disease. It's part of a special issue on climate change and vector-borne diseases of humans, and that's in the journal Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society B. Daniel Brooks is currently a senior research scientist with the Mantar Laboratory of Parasitology at the University of Nebraska in Lincoln. Daniel, thank you so much for sharing your time and expertise, as scary as it might be sometimes.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This interview with Daniel Brooks has a couple of key thoughts. First, while humans mentally long for a single threat where we can focus, the natural world is too complex to accommodate that need. Unlike the movie The Andromeda Strain, the experts don't think we will run into a single giant disease or parasite to knock off our species. AIDS, Ebola, and West Nile virus arrive and manage to stay around but don't do us in. By the way, if I sounded disappointed in the West Nile virus after the initial hype, here's some news. The extra warm, dry conditions in California brought the highest level of West Nile virus ever seen in that state. There were 798 human cases in 2014, five times the number recorded in 2011 at the start of this big drought. 29 people died last year. You might think drier weather means less mosquito-borne diseases like West Nile virus, but streams and even rivers that normally keep running enough to keep clear of mosquito larvae end up with more stagnant pools to breed. Plus, with fewer water sources, more species come to those that are left, meaning a better transfer station for diseases to all kinds of species. The Sacramento YOLO Mosquito Control is warning Californians to expect, quote, an intense West Nile virus year. It's just another unexpected spin-off of climate change and the very thing Dr. Brooks warned us about. Meanwhile, the news is full of more examples of how climate change will influence the appearance of new diseases and pests. Just this past week, a new study from Oslo, Norway, rewrote the history books of how the Black Plague hit Europe in the 1300s and kept coming back for hundreds of years afterwards. According to the book Genghis Khan and the Making of the Modern World, about 90% of the people in the Hopi province of China died from the plague in 1331. 90%. 15 years later, the disease made it to the Volga River in Russia. The Mongol Empire partly ended because their Pony Express system, which likely spread the disease, couldn't find enough riders left alive. Scientists now think that periods of warmer and wetter weather in Asia stimulated the populations of plague-carrying ticks. And these were mostly carried by gerbils, not the black rat. The gerbils likely spread the plague to pack animals. Evidence seems to show that the plague did not stay resident in Europe's rats, as we thought, but instead kept arriving from Asia following warm weather spells there. Rats carrying the plague were themselves killed off, rather than harboring the horrible disease. Europe was reinfected dozens of times, hundreds of times. Investigating over 7,000 outbreaks of the plague, scientists from the University of Oslo found that weather in Europe was not a factor, but a warming spell in Asia was. The plague arrived about 15 years after each warming period in Asia. Like today, other factors like immigration and wars also helped spread the disease. So we don't know all the surprises coming our way as this next warming pumps up the population of disease-bearing organisms. Oh, and by the way, a brand new deadly virus was just discovered in a man in Kansas at the end of this February. He'd been bitten by ticks in the spring of 2014. It took a while for the U.S. Centers for Disease Control to realize this was a brand new virus never before seen. The best we can do about all this, Brooks says, is A, admit that climate change is real, and then B, start funding research and building infrastructure to deal with new pests and diseases. We know they're coming. Right now, even in the West, hospitals are operating on a just barely basis. Agriculture is likewise dependent on a business model with no backup system and no fallback position. It's not like we are rationally ready for 1,000 challenges from the micro world, much less from the insects. That's our time for this week. There are some solutions, but they all start with accepting what is real. I'm Alex Smith Thank you for listening, and join us again next week on Radio EcoShock.